it is up to us to add our voices and our votes to the chorus of history, echoing heroes like John Lewis, who said, "When you see something that is not right, you must say something. You must do something." That is the truest form of empathy. Not just feeling, but doing. Not just for ourselves or our kids, but for everyone, for all our kids. And if we want to keep the possibility of progress alive in our time, if we want to be able to look our children in the eye after this election, we have got to reassert our place in American history.
Michelle Obama, during the Democratic National Convention yesterday, speaking the night before the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. That amendment guarantees the right to vote in the United States would not be denied on the basis of sex. August 18th, 1920, 100 years ago today, the culmination of a fight that took decades and forever enshrined the names like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and Lucretia Mott in our history books. But there were other women who were neither white nor straight who played key roles but have not been recognized. And we're going to talk about them with Veronica Chambers, author and editor of the New York Times Archival Project Past Tense. Welcome to the program, Veronica.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us, Sally Rush Wagner. She's an historian at Syracuse University and author of the anthology, The Women's Suffrage Movement. Welcome to you.
Oh, thank you. I'm so delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you. Well, Veronica, there is a deep connection between the suffrage movement and the abolitionist movement, the movement to abolish slavery. Many of the early suffragists found a voice in that movement. But why did it take another 50 years after Reconstruction for women to earn the right to vote?
Well, I think one of the things that we see really early on is that the 15th Amendment splits the movement. You know, just to put it in the plainest terms, a lot of white women who are super unhappy that Black men are going to get the vote before them. And that causes a huge split between the movement. And, you know, it was a complicated time. And I think many people felt that Black men needed the vote to not have slavery return. And what you see again and again, right after Reconstruction, is that free Black men are and women are kidnapped and sold back into slavery. So it becomes a really thorny issue.
And Sally, how did that figure into the fight for suffrage in places in the South of the United States?
I think if we look later in 1890, the movement has split. And it's really more a movement toward vote only movement. Before that, they're raising every issue that we're still raising today, from equal pay to reproductive justice. But by 1890, what they begin to do is to use racism as policy. They say, give women the right to vote if you want to maintain white supremacy. Because look, there are more white women than there are people of color, and there are more white women than there are immigrants. So you give us the vote, and we white women will give you white native-born supremacy continuing.
Meaning that they would only vote for policies that would ensure discrimination and racism? That if white women voted, they would make sure to maintain people in power who would preserve white power?
That was the dog whistle underneath the argument, yes.
Wow. And so, Veronica, did they sideline some of the non-white activists in the movement?
I think that one of the things that we found as journalists was how many women of color who were involved with the suffragist movement. And I think that their voices and stories aren't told as much as they could be, partly because I think that people didn't want to talk about racism within the suffrage movement. I think they wanted to look at these women as heroes and really focus on the gains and wins for women without looking at the messiness of the race stuff.
So one of the women of color who's been overlooked, frankly, is a woman named Mary Church Terrell. Veronica, tell us about her.
Mary Church Terrell is definitely, I think, one of our favorites, one of our heroes. She was born to enslaved parents. She became one of the first Black women to graduate from Oberlin. She spoke multiple languages. And, you know, one of the things that you sort of find is that I think it was hard for people to really engage and appreciate within the lens of the time they were in, the super well-educated, middle and upper class Black women like Mary Church Terrell, and see them as the equals that they were. And she's somebody who I think one of the things that you learn is that for women of color, their suffrage is never just the only thing on the agenda. So after abolition, they're fighting anti-lynching, they're fighting for child labor laws, they're fighting for temperance and fighting against domestic violence. And Mary Church Terrell is someone whose life like really shows that arc. And she came up with the phrase, lifting as we climb. And really that idea that if suffragists are gonna do their best work, they have to open the door to equality to as many people as possible.
And what was the reception to that argument?
It's important to say that the move for suffrage starts before Seneca Falls and Sally's work on the Haudenosaunee women and how Native American women were central to the suffrage story is so important. But if you think it starts way before Seneca Falls in the 1840s, and 1920 is really the beginning and goes through the Voting Rights Act, but even if you just look at the 19th Amendment from the early 1800s to the 1920, there was this feeling that it took three generations of women to get the vote. It was never promised. And so I think there was a feeling among some, particularly white women suffragists, that they had to be single-minded about suffrage. Whereas I think for women of color, they felt like we can't lay down some issues like lynching while we focus on suffrage. We have to keep all the issues going. And there's a kind of a multiplicity of activism that really marks their work that becomes really important.
Sally, you've spent a lot of your career studying the Native American influence on this movement, and specifically the Iroquois women of upstate New York. Tell us about their role in this.
There are connections between the suffrage leaders in this region. I am in the indigenous territory of the Onondaga Nation, which is the center of the Haudenosaunee Six Nation Confederacy. And the clan mothers have for 1,000 years at least been nominating, holding in office, and removing, if necessary, the chiefs that they choose to sit on the Grand Council and the decision-making body. So I think the suffragists, they saw women who had their own authority, their own political voice, who were economically independent, who were part of a community that was based on balance and harmony. And they saw a vision of a transformed world that made it possible for them to demand their rights.
That is so inspiring and yet also so tragic when you think of the modern day plight of so many Native American women. Many indigenous women are victims of a lot of domestic violence. Murders often go unsolved or even they're not investigated. And it just seems like such a heartbreaking come down from what you've just described.
Well, the irony is that at the same time that settler colonialist women were learning from the Haudenosaunee, the government and the churches were systematically trying to destroy the sovereignty and the culture of Native Americans. And the result of the systematic violence against them, the regimentation, the lack of love, is an intergenerational trauma that continues today.
I would love to just jump in also and add that I think that history becomes really important because it is a reminder of the power that women have had and a reminder that that idea, the reminder that, you know, this is a second wave on this land, that this is the second tongue that we're speaking, is really important. And suffrage is actually an opportunity to look at that in a concrete, not ethereal way.
Absolutely.
What about women who were not heteronormative? What role did they play in this movement?
They're everywhere in the movement. Women who could afford not to marry, they formed partnerships and lived together for, you know, years and years, their whole lives, sometimes their whole adult lives. And they were emotionally devoted to each other. I think when we look at lesbians, we think, you know, well, what were they doing in bed? And I think that's not the question. The question is, what was the nature of their emotional relationships? And that's where we see them everywhere.
Interesting. So as we're celebrating the 100th anniversary, what do you think we should be thinking about now, given all of your research, given the fact that we are 100 years into it, which seems like a long time, but is really not a long time at all? And as we're looking at another historic election right around the corner, what should women be thinking as they head to the ballot box and consider the gains that they have won and things that they still need to win? Veronica.
So one of the things that we thought a lot about, which turned out to be really tricky to sort of show in a visual way, was what is the correlation between when women won the vote and when women in different countries have been able to ascend to the highest offices in the land. And I think a lot about a quote that Emmeline Pankhurst, the British suffragist, said when she said, "We're not here because we want to break laws. We're here in our attempt to become lawmakers." And as we look at Kamala Harris's historic nomination, we realize she's one of 26 women serving in Senate, 101 representatives in the House, governors of just 9 states, as well as the territories of Puerto Rico and Guam. These are numbers are so low, but they would also be unimaginable if women had not won the vote.
Sally?
I think about, well, what should women be thinking about? I can just tell you what I'm thinking about. What I'm thinking about is the African-American women who organized in a lot of different issues. And I think the message for us out of the suffrage movement, at least for me, one of them is that it's the people who are the most oppressed who have the most leadership to offer. The rich white guys, they only see their own interests. It's very hard for them to see beyond that. But the queer women, poor, of color, see all of the different issues and all of the interplay that needs to be corrected. So I feel celebratory. I also feel the sadness at seeing the extraordinary voices of women of color coming forward today and speaking truth to power and showing a leadership that we lost for over 100 years because the African-American women really didn't get the vote until 1965. And when I was listening to Michelle Obama's speech, I thought, that should have been with us 100 years ago. We should have been hearing those voices all that time, and we haven't. And that's the terrible loss we must make up for now.
Sally Rush Wagner from Syracuse University, Veronica Chambers from the New York Times. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a wonderful day to be able to celebrate the 19th Amendment with both of you. Thank you.
Thank you. I feel the same.
Coming up, a conversation with Katie Hill, part of the wave of women who won a seat in Congress in 2018, but less than a year later, she resigned after nude photos of her were released, and she admitted to having a relationship with a campaign staffer. A warning, some of what we discuss is sensitive material. My conversation with Katie Hill next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Former Congresswoman Katie Hill became a political star from the moment she won her House race in 2018. She flipped a traditionally red district in northern L.A. County blue, despite never having run for any office before. She was one of the youngest people ever elected to Congress, one of its first openly bisexual members. And she was picked to represent the historic class of freshman Democrats in meetings with party leadership. She became a favorite of Speaker Nancy Pelosi. But in less than a year, it was all gone. She resigned her seat last November after nude pictures of her were leaked to a conservative website. The site also revealed that Hill had a relationship with a campaign staffer, which she confirmed, and it accused her of having an affair with someone else, which she denies. Speaking on the House floor on her last day in office, Hill blamed a double standard for women in public office.
Yes, I'm stepping down. But I refuse to let this experience scare off other women who dare to take risks, who dare to step into this light, who dare to be powerful. It might feel like they won in the short term, but they can't in the long term. We cannot let them. The way to overcome this setback is for women to keep showing up, to keep running for office, to keep stepping up as leaders, because the more we show up, the less power they have.
Well, Hill is back now. She has a new political action committee and a new book that's part memoir and part manifesto. It's called She Will Rise, Becoming a Warrior in the Battle for True Equality. And Katie Hill joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's go back to that day. It wasn't really that long ago, although with COVID and everything, everything feels like a lifetime ago. But that was really towards the end of 2019. The day you gave that speech, you were wearing a bright red suit, red lipstick, your armor, as you've called it. And what was it like making that speech?
So the days leading up to it were horrible. But I was, the day that I had to give the speech, I felt like I'd, you know, I'd composed myself. I felt prepared. I felt as confident as I could be. And I felt defiant. And it was that defiance that I wanted to ensure got across and that other people kind of picked up on, especially other women, because, you know, I recognized my part that, you know, the responsibility that I held in resigning, the responsibility that I had for the relationship with the staffer, for all of it. But I also know that, you know, we see women that are treated in positions of power far differently from men. The perfect example of that is Donald Trump, who has been accused by over 25 women of sexual misconduct. And, you know, that's not even on the list of the things that we really talk about anymore, because everything else has been such a catastrophic disaster. So I think that my desire in that speech was to get across that I was going to find a way to come back and that I was going to find a way to continue to make an impact on the issues that mattered to me and to so many other people. So I had to kind of find my way. I had a pretty disastrous year, even unrelated to this. I was going through a divorce from this abusive marriage. 2 months after I resigned, my 20-year-old brother died suddenly. And, you know, that was a tragedy. My mom had brain surgery. And then, you know, we go into COVID with everybody else.
Yeah.
So
wow.
It's been a lot to recover from. But I'm glad that I'm standing back up and hopefully showing that this isn't something that can take a woman down permanently. And hopefully the next woman who's in a position like this doesn't feel like she has to resign.
Well, I think a lot of people wondered why you did feel you had to resign. Even Nancy Pelosi urged you not to, even though, yes, you had had this relationship with a campaign staffer and that was inappropriate. It wasn't against the rules, but inappropriate, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You didn't have to resign, but you did. And in the book, I feel like you're a little ambivalent about your decision.
I think that's accurate. I mean, I don't want to say that I regret it because I felt at the time like it was the only option to make it stop. You know, I was getting bombarded by this every single day. There were, you know, new photos or new stories. And I didn't feel like there was any way to make it stop if I didn't resign. And especially in the context of my marriage and feeling this just huge weight of responsibility, this huge weight of how guilty I felt that I was even putting people in this situation. The fact that, you know, the campaign staffer who was involved, was her name was exposed and her face was exposed. And, my family and she were being followed all over the place by the media, and my staff was being threatened constantly. They had white powder that was delivered to the office. My family, you know, they had posters that had been put up in my hometown that were just, you know, vile. And it just felt like so much. We were about to go into impeachment, and I knew even if my colleagues would defend me, I knew that I didn't want them to be in the position of having to do that with everything else. So at the time, it felt like the right thing to do. I think, you know, could I have stuck it out? Possibly. We'll never know. But I hope that what I can do now is try to make sure that more women are elevated to positions of power.
You said that you seriously considered suicide before resigning. You said you came scarily close. How scarily close?
Well, I've talked about this in the op-ed I wrote for the New York Times and in the book, but I was in the bathtub and I had a knife and I was very close. And what stopped me was thinking about how that would impact people, what that would show. And frankly, coming out of that was a big part of how I felt like I needed to give my speech and find a way out of it. And frankly, you know, I'm so glad that I did. But it's more than half of the people who have been victims of cyber exploitation, according to multiple studies, say that they've seriously contemplated or have attempted suicide in the aftermath of it. And when I say cyber exploitation, I mean what a lot of people refer to as revenge porn. And the suicidal ideation around or in the aftermath of that kind of an incident is even higher than that of women who are actually raped. And I think it's because your power is totally taken away. Your power of not just in one moment or in one situation, but forever. Those images are in your body are not your own anymore. For as long as they're out there, you're going to have to just deal with the fact that people have seen you like this and have known these things about you that were never supposed to be known and that you never intended to share. And in my case, I didn't even know that those pictures existed, or at least most of them that they existed. So being able to come out of that has been a real exercise in trying to claim your power back in whatever way you can.
And so you didn't even know your husband, your ex-husband, had taken all of those photos?
No, not at all. And, you know, I had a lot of people say, well, how could you not have known? And it's like, people are carrying around their cell phones all the time. And apparently he was sneaky with it. And I just had no idea. He'd been posting photos even while I was running for Congress on these websites that were, yeah, I don't even want to say what they were on radio. But
why was he doing that? Why was he doing that while you were campaigning?
I've thought a lot about that. I think that there was at least a part of him that wanted to sabotage me even while I was running for Congress, you know, because basically as I was running and once I got into Congress, I think he felt me slipping away. He felt his control kind of loosening and that he might not be able to sustain it.
You write that you guys got together when you were really young, right? You were 16.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And was he as volatile and violent or prone to violent outbursts the whole time, or did it become worse the more power you got?
It certainly escalated in the later years. I think, you know, when you start a relationship, and I talk about this in the book too, but I started that relationship on the heels of sexual assault. So you don't have any sense of what is normal or healthy about a sexual or romantic relationship as a teenager. And I think it, having been in that relationship from the time that you're so young, your perception of what's normal is conditioned to, you know, to the point where you don't really have any idea if these things are healthy or not. And it takes time away from it. It takes, you know, a lot of self-reflection. In my case, it took a lot of therapy to even realize that I was in a situation that was problematic. And I tried to leave him before, even before the election. And that's when he said that if you leave, I'll ruin you. And it was just a few months later that he apparently leaked the photos.
He says he didn't, that he was hacked, but you don't believe that?
No, I don't believe that for a second.
Have you spoken to him since all of this?
No. Unfortunately, divorce proceedings have been delayed because of COVID, along with many things, but he won't sign he wouldn't sign a divorce agreement. And so we're waiting on trial setting, which was supposed to happen in March and then got postponed to May because of COVID and then got postponed again to October. So no, definitely no communication outside of our lawyers. And even that, there have been periods where he's disappeared, where documents were supposed to come and they didn't. And, I think personally, and again, this from according to my divorce lawyer and my cyber civil rights attorneys, that this is a common power play, that when men in abusive dynamics have lost any other way of controlling you, they hang on to the last things they have. And in this case, it's not letting me get divorced.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You have had quite a year.
Yeah.
One of the most powerful parts of your book is when you write about your grandmother, and you write about learning how she was in an abusive relationship with your grandfather, something you never knew, but also something that really gobsmacked you because you idolized him. You credit him for inspiring you to get into politics. He urged you to be a warrior, right?
Yep.
And so when she told you these stories of being emotionally abused by him, he didn't physically abuse her from what I can tell, from what you wrote.
No.
But he was incredibly controlling, and she was miserable with him. Mm-hmm. When she told you these stories of how he treated her, like how did you reconcile that with a man that you knew?
That was very difficult. And I'd heard little bits of it before. So my grandfather passed away in 2011 from Alzheimer's. He was like another father figure in my life. I was so close to him. I was at his bedside the entire time as he was dying. And I can't even indicate enough how important he was to me. So when I started to find some of this stuff out, just kind of in the periphery, I was like, this can't be real. That couldn't possibly be true. But once I started talking to my grandmother for the book, it just kind of opened up this floodgate. And I knew from my own experience that there's no way that you speak like this or you understand this kind of stuff in the way that you do, unless it has actually happened to you. So, and then I believed it too, right? Like once you look at it objectively, once you're able to kind of separate yourself from it and from your perceptions of who this person was when you idolized him, when he's your hero, you can see how some of those behaviors might manifest. And when I started to look at it that way, one of the pieces that I've had that I really wanted to explore in the book was not only, the aspects of abuse and everything like that, but my own kind of having to reconcile my role in it. Right. And did I perpetuate any of the abuse, especially with the staff on my campaign? And I think that it sort of helped me come to grips with my own guilt and shame and trying to figure out how to move on.
Wait, are you saying that you feel like you became an abuser?
Well, I worry about that, right? I worry that I wasn't aware enough or careful enough about the power dynamic, and that part of that might have been because of stuff that I'd experienced. And so, I'm on Me Too lists now, right? I'm frequently, if I look at the comments, I'm called a sexual predator. And that's a really hard thing to hear if you're somebody who's actually been a victim of it. So, that's something that you have to kind of try to wrap your head around, right? Mm.
It surprised me that you said that what you're taking away from this lesson from your grandfather is that you may have unconsciously replicated his behavior, whereas I was thinking you unconsciously replicated your grandmother's behavior with your ex-husband.
I mean, I think that that's both. That's the thing that I was trying to wrap my head around was, have I done both?
So you form this pack, and it's to help other candidates, other women, win political office. Why did you want to start this pack?
So when I left, you have the option of basically you have to figure out what you're going to do with your reelection funds that you'd already amassed. And in my case, because it was a competitive reelection, I'd already raised over $1 million. And you can either leave it in your campaign account in case you ever want to run for something, federal office again, or you can give it out, or you can convert it to a PAC. And I wanted to convert it to a PAC because I knew, and I felt like I promised this as part of my speech, as part of, you know, my resignation, that that I had to keep fighting for these issues in some way. And that if I wasn't going to be there, then I needed to double down on helping other women get there. And I know, you know, having experienced it from the campaign, the extra hurdles that are in place for women, and how much more difficult it is to get across those initial ones, including fundraising. So I wanted to do that. I also wanted with the PAC to be able to advocate for legislation, which is another piece that we're doing. And then lastly, I think that there's not enough research to figure out what it is that mobilizes young women as a voting bloc. I think if women between 18 and 40 really become a kind of powerful, you know, and consistent voting bloc, then we are the ones that are going to be able to elect women up and down the ballot.
And would you ever run for office again? You're very young.
Yeah, that's why I haven't written it off entirely. I don't have any immediate desire or plans to. I feel like I've still got a lot of healing to do. And I think that I have a role to play outside of being an elected official for now that I really am excited about and trying to figure it out. But I'm about to turn 33, and I figure I've got plenty of time if it makes sense down the road to reenter the arena.
Former Congresswoman Katie Hill, her new book is called She Will Rise, Becoming a Warrior in the Battle for True Equality. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, those rolling blackouts in California, they have to do with our move to clean energy. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The only thing worse than a record-breaking heat wave is a record-breaking heat wave with no power for the AC or even for a fan. California utilities are using rolling blackouts to deal with an energy shortage, shutting off power when the grid is strained, like now when everyone's at home pumping the AC. The last time this happened was during an energy crisis nearly 20 years ago. Now that it's happening again, sometimes with little or no warning, political leaders are asking why. Governor Gavin Newsom ordered an investigation earlier this week after reports that the state's transition to cleaner energy is partly to blame.
We cannot sacrifice reliability as we move forward in this transition. And we're going to be much more aggressive in focusing our efforts and our intention in making sure that that is the case. It goes without saying, you deserve and also demand what happened.
With me to talk about this is Sammy Roth. He's an LA Times reporter who covers energy. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
So what's the connection there between transitioning to other forms of energy and these rolling blackouts?
So it's a little bit complicated. The independent system operator, which runs the power grid for most of the state, they basically came out and said yesterday, renewables are not really the problem here, is the way they put it. It's a question of having enough power and specifically having enough power at the right times. The connection to the clean energy thing, which Governor Newsom is talking about, is specifically the issue that we saw over the weekend and could see again this week, is a question of having adequate power supplies on hand in the evening, specifically after all of the solar panels go offline and stop generating electricity. There's this transition that happens every evening where we're generating lots and lots of solar during the afternoon, and then when the sun goes down, that all goes away. There are definitely ways to deal with that and sort of continue on with the clean energy and climate goals that California has, but it's a challenge, and it's a challenge that the grid operator says we're pretty much experiencing for the first time in a serious way right now.
Because it's not so easy to store solar power?
Well, that's one of the potential solutions here. I mean, it used to be a lot harder. Storage, like solar was once, used to be much more expensive. It's gotten a lot cheaper. The utilities in California have been ordered over the next couple of years to bring a lot more storage online so that you can sort of shift some of that power from the afternoon into the evenings. But not that much of that has happened yet, and it definitely seems like there's a need to do more of that more quickly.
So why are these rolling blackouts necessary, and why are they happening now?
So basically, what's going on is this mismatch where power demand has been staying, you know, really high into the evenings because it's so hot and because it's staying hot late into the day and at night. The power supply, as I said, from the solar is going away, and it's a question of is there enough to meet it. The reason that the grid operator has been calling these rolling outages is because they basically desperately want to avoid a situation where there's more demand for electricity than there is supply, because if that happens, like, the grid could go haywire. Basically, you'd have chaos. You'd have massive, sudden, unexpected outages all over the place. So rather than reach that sort of emergency, you know, critical point where there's just not enough and things start to, you know, to black out, they want to have a somewhat more orderly, you know, turning off of relatively smaller amounts of people, sort of with a method to it to prevent something much larger and more catastrophic from occurring.
So who's at risk of having to deal with this rolling blackout?
Pretty much anyone who's a customer of Southern California Edison, Pacific Gas and Electric, or San Diego Gas and Electric. The way this works is that the grid operator, known as the ISO, they basically are determining each evening, are we going to be short tonight? And if we are short, they're basically parceling out the outages to those three big utilities and, you know, in proportion to the population they serve and sort of giving them in order to turn off power to blocks of people to the extent that's needed. Worth noting that if you live in the city of Los Angeles and you're an LADWP customer or a couple of other parts of the state, Sacramento and the Imperial Valley in particular, those are separate electric systems, separate from the main power system in the state that we're talking about, and those folks have not been affected at all.
Why is LADWP in such good shape?
Well, LADWP has its own dedicated power sources. It has its own gas plants and solar farms and other sources of power that are just dedicated to the city. And it seems that we have the supply we need at the moment, and the rest of the state does not.
Hmm. Well, is there something the rest of the state could learn from LADWP?
That's an interesting question. LADWP, like the rest of the state, is, you know, in the middle of trying to figure out this transition to, you know, to 100% clean power sources. And you know, we definitely have a lot of solar and wind in City of LA. In some ways, the city is a little bit behind the state. City of LA still operates a coal plant in the state of Utah, which is kind of interesting, which is still a fairly significant source of our power. I'm not saying that's necessarily why the lights have stayed on, but I just think it's a little bit more tricky than what is the lesson from LA, because it's the same stuff that's going to be challenging for the whole state is going to be challenging for Los Angeles as well.
Right. And they've gotten a lot of criticism for getting energy from this dirty coal plant. Meanwhile, so customers who are not customers of LADWP, who are at risk of being subjected to these rolling blackouts, are they getting enough warning?
So far, the warning has not been that great. We had these blackouts on Friday evening and then again more briefly on Saturday evening. And in both of those cases, the grid operator that calls this stuff did not give people a lot of warning. And in fact, on Saturday in particular, they went from a situation from where they were saying, you know, there's not even a risk of blackouts to very, very suddenly, oh, there are blackouts that we're doing right now. They said, you know, took the blame for that on Monday and acknowledged that, you know, they had screwed up and thought we were in better shape than we were, hence the lack of notice. Things were a little different on Monday when during the day they predicted that if things played out like they thought was going to happen, that we could have the biggest outages by far on Monday evening. They were expecting something much worse than Saturday and Sunday. But what ended up happening was, one, temperatures were a little bit lower than expected, and two, people actually started listening in a big way to these flex alerts and saving energy, so demand was less than expected. And so it ultimately didn't happen Monday, but still to be seen for the next few days.
So one of the problems, obviously, is it's really, really hot. But the other problem is that people are at home now more than ever and using electricity, right? If you've got your whole family at home playing video games, watching TV, running the air conditioner, the dishwasher, washing machine, et cetera, you're going to be straining the grid.
Yeah, I've seen some conflicting information and reports on that. In general, yes. Of course, that's been tempered over the course of the pandemic by, you know, offices and shopping malls and, you know, industrial places being closed or ramping back. That's starting to change as, you know, the economy, for better or for worse, has somewhat reopened. So you do have that at-home demand and some of the stuff out there. So in general, yes, it's an issue. And it's certainly an issue for those of us who are stuck at home experiencing this. I mean, if this were a different time, you could go to a cooling center or a library or a movie theater or somewhere where it would be easier to stay cool if you either couldn't afford to do so at home or didn't have air conditioning. And now that's not possible in a lot of ways.
Sammy Roth covers energy for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks, Sammy.
You're welcome.
Coming up, Victoria Rowell was one of the few black faces on soap operas for a long time. She says she was retaliated against when she fought for more inclusion behind the scenes. A conversation with her next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for TV on the radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get those.
Oh, my God.
No. Not that one. Not that theme. Let's try this one. Ah, yes. The soap opera, The Young and the Restless. It's been a staple of daytime TV since the early 1970s. For 15 of those years, Victoria Rowell played the feisty character of Drusilla Winters. Off screen, she has fought against racism in daytime television, and she addresses many of these issues in her podcast, Secrets of a Soap Opera Diva.
These casting directors, who are all white, there are no department heads that I know, Young and the Restless, Bold and the Beautiful, Days of Our Lives, General Hospital. I don't know any of those casting directors, and before them, to be black.
Well, Victoria Rowell joins me now to talk more about this. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. Good to be here. How are you doing?
Good to have you. I'm doing well. Thanks for coming on. And let's just talk about your character, Drusilla. First of all, that name is fantastic, but it's quite an iconic role, quite an iconic character. Talk about who she is and why she resonated with so many viewers.
Well, the character name, I researched it. It's actually in the Bible. The character really became iconic because she was so relatable to so many people across a variety of ethnic groups. I learned this because I travel. I'm not one of those people that buys red bottoms and fancy cars. I invest in travel. And so from Greece to Turkey to Africa, wherever Sony distributed the show, this character really resonated with especially populations of lower socioeconomic environments. Not exclusively so, but the character is a puller up by the bootstraps character. And we watch the evolution of this character from being illiterate to an adult literacy program. I asked the powers that be to consider a foster care adoption storyline based on, you know, inspired by my own experience in foster care. And the character meant more to me than just a part. I was working, you know, with Jim Carrey and with Dick Van Dyke and with Sam Jackson and big, big luminary stars. But this show equally was important to me, I believe, because of my foster care experience. I knew that I could reach millions of people daily and around the globe. Viacom CBS has been rerunning episodes up until just recently of my character, and the audience has just come out to ask a lot of questions that perhaps they hadn't asked before.
What kind of questions?
People have long asked, even before COVID, which is why the reruns, Sony and CBS, Viacom CBS had to show reruns because they ran out of episodes after 47 years, first time in their history. And people want to know what it's like behind the scenes, not only in terms of the character play, but also who's behind the camera? How does a show run? The questions have changed over time. People really understand now what I was fighting for in terms of, you know, fairness, parity, economic inclusion behind the camera. I mean, when did diversity become a dirty word, Madeline? I just don't know. But I think with the sweeping changes over at Viacom CBS for diversity, we are beginning to see some wheels change over there. I hope that daytime is included in the conversation. Oftentimes, nobody pays attention to that silly little genre called soap opera. Nothing silly about a $50 million a year budget.
So you began raising these questions. Why aren't there Black writers? Why aren't there Black EPs, showrunners, what have you, on daytime soap operas? And you were still on The Young and the Restless at the time. What was the immediate reaction when you started raising these questions?
There was a sense of, you know, mind your business, but I felt it was a part of my business. My objective was to help the show that I worked hard on, to help them keep up with the times. So, you know, I pushed for a Black hairstylist. That was met with a lot of resistance just to put a button on what happened. The Black cast was then relegated to get our hair done in a separate but equal room at CBS. It was outrageous. The writers thought it would be funny if they had my hair fall out in the storyline on the show. It just went on and on. Lots of punitive behaviors. And then ultimately, one of the most egregious behaviors was being saddled with a $20,000 fine by Sony Pictures Television, Steve Kent, who is still in charge at Sony Pictures Television, stating that I allegedly missed a day of work out of all of the years I worked on the show. And that's when I called the NAACP. SAG-AFTRA stepped in after at the time and said, you will not, this is illegal, and you will give her back every penny.
And you left the show and sued Sony, right? And settled, I believe.
Yes, we settled. I sued. I filed a lawsuit against Sony and others for the reprehensible behaviors exacted against me in retaliation for speaking out on lack of diversity. They did not want it to get out that there were barely any Black people ever hired behind the camera in daytime. And of course, it's systemic. So they tried to punish, and they punished quite severely. I call it artistic house arrest, because it's not just the soap opera. I mean, the tentacles are wide and long. They all know each other at the top. So I'd book a job, and before I left, my agent would call and say, it's gone away, Vicky. I was on Law & Order, for example, playing a recurring judge. It went away.
Why do you think it is that soap operas haven't caught up to Evening when it comes to representation? I mean, you have Scandal, Empire, a whole host of soap operas at night that are focused on Black characters and Black life and are run by Black creatives and written by Black writers. And yet you describe the complete opposite in daytime. Why hasn't daytime caught up?
Right. Because no one bothers them. So when you also consider that these soap operas were privately owned, William Bell created, with his wife, Lee Philip Bell, out of Chicago, they created The Young and the Restless. And one of the most difficult things to do, National Urban League President Mark Morial said to me, is to change a privately held company. We're at a place right now where ViacomCBS has the opportunity as the licensor. Procter & Gamble has an opportunity as the leading corporate advertising sponsor to say, wait a minute. You mean to tell me that the Bell Phillip family owns two shows, The Young and the Restless and The Bold and the Beautiful, combined, and not a single Black showrunner, not a single Black executive producer or head writer or casting director or PR person? I could just go on. Anything, as I say, that is bringing in millions of dollars in revenues needs to be a part of the conversation. It's one of the oldest forms of entertainment, as it started on radio, soap opera, selling Oxydol soap for Procter & Gamble to housewives.
Yeah, and it has survived. I mean, it's slimmed down. A lot of shows have gone off the air. A lot of stalwarts, like All My Children, One Life to Live, canceled. But as you say, it carries on in other forms. Do you think eventually you'll be back on a soap?
I really don't think about that. you know, there were folks that called me the Sojourner Truth of CBS, and because they would bring their grievances to me and I would bring them forth. This is not a hobby for me. I saw injustice in foster care, great injustice, and it is a part of who I am. And it's not just for me, it's for hundreds of other people whose careers have been stunted due to racism.
You have the podcast and you're still acting. What can we see you in now?
Right. So we have the podcast, Secrets of a Soap Opera Diva, which is a lot of fun. It's behind the scenes and the history. And we talk about economic inclusion in daypart television. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention my do-it-yourself reality show that launched this summer that's on Amazon Prime and Prime Video and UMC, which is titled Trash versus Treasure, where I reimagine very tight spaces for working mothers living below the poverty line. And it seems to have caught fire. People really love the show, and I'm really proud of it. So visit the website, trashversustreasure.com. Hmm.
Well, Victoria Rowell, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Victoria Rowell, actress and creator and host of the podcast, Secrets of a Soap Opera Diva. And that's it for us today on Press Play. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.